Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Darrow, this hour of the program, I've been greatly looking forward to it. He did not believe our guest writes in free will, nor good and evil, nor choice. There were no moral absolutes, no truth and justice. There was only mercy. Darrow said, "We are all poor, blind creatures bound hand and foot by the invisible chains of heredity and environment, doing pretty much what we have to do in a barbarous and cruel world. That's about all there is to any court case." And he had over 2,000 court cases. He, of course, was involved in the Scopes trial, probably the most famous. But our guest asked which of his clients won him the public's greatest respect or interest. Pendergast, the mentally ill man who killed the mayor of Chicago. The homosexual thrill killers, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, who murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks. Or James McNamara and his brother John, responsible for the bombing of the L.A. Times and the fiery death of 20 employees. How about Big Bill Haywood, the leftist union rabble-rouser, accused of deploying union executioners and assassins, the socialist Eugene Debs, the anarchists arrested for the Haymarket bombing, the American communists in the days of the Red Scare after World War I, or perhaps in that era of prejudice and bigotry, it was the black men whom Darrow volunteered to defend. We talk about Clarence Darrow, attorney for the damned, this hour of our program. John Farrell is our guest. He has a new book, and a very thorough one and highly interesting, on Clarence Darrow. He's also the author of the best-selling Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. He has worked as an editor at the Boston Globe. He's worked for the Denver Post and is a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org for you to join our conversation. John, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much. I feel that I should just shut up and let you keep talking.
I have so many pages of notes because I love the book. What a great subject for a biography. The guy was so multi-layered, and I was unaware of many of the cases. 2,000 cases this guy had. Wow.
They give you a very wonderful portrait, too, of America in a very important time, and yet one that's really neglected, I think, by history, and that's the time after the Civil War. Up through World War I to the eve of World War II.
Yeah. Tell me a little. I always like to start with people's parents because you get some of who you are, I think, deep in yourself from your parents. And his father was an interesting guy. He must have taken some of his thoughts about the world and about religion and many things from his dad.
Yeah, there was a streak of independence in the Darrow family. They were. He had several relatives, ancestors who had fought in the American Revolution, and they had a way of sort of picking up and following the frontier west. And by the time it got around to his dad's generation, which was the first part of the 19th century, they had settled in a portion of northeast Ohio and known as the Western Reserve. And it was a place where an awful lot of New Englanders came with the sort of puritanical family opinions, but very radical political opinions. And it became, in fact, a place where a lot of abolitionist sympathy existed. It was a place where the Underground Railroad ran through. And Darrow's dad was sort of a small-town radical, a small-town heretic. He believed very much in the abolitionist cause. But he also was what was known then as a free thinker, meaning that he challenged the tenets of organized religion, and he spent an extraordinary amount of time doing two things. One was having children. He had a very large family, but the other was he did a tremendous amount of reading, and the house that they lived in was just jammed with books, different philosophers and political theory, and so Darrow grew up in a very unusual household for rural America.
The literature plays such a strong role, not only in Clarence Darrow's life, the things he read, but the people who were with him, some of the great writers of the age. One was a law partner. He knew a lot of these people. Tell me about that part of his life.
Sure. His law partner was Edgar Lee Masters, the famous poet who wrote series of poems that were published together called the Spoon River Anthology that some of us still had to read in high school.
High school requirement.
Yeah, and they were and they were kind of a naturalism. But he also had great friends in journalism, in the Muckrakers, in Lincoln Steffens, for example, was a very good friend of his. He was friends with a great number of the artists that came in what was called the Chicago Renaissance. He moved from Northeast Ohio to Chicago, which is where he did most of his practice, and so he was, and he was a literary man himself. He wrote two novels, some wonderful essays, and one of the novels, which is called A Farmington, stands up very well even to this day. It's sort of a very acidic portrait of small town life in the Midwest.
Mm. Should we read it?
I would think so. It's not. I mean, don't go to it thinking that you're going to be dazzled. It's a very subtle book. It has lots of nice little stories about growing up in this small town and what it was like. And then it's a while before you realize that there's a very deep fatalistic criticism there that Darrow has hidden quite cleverly. And at the time, he got a lot of reviews that said, oh, this is sort of an idyllic Tom Sawyer-type book. And then a few reviewers who said, no, this isn't Tom Sawyer. This man is throwing acid over the whole a picture of small-town America.
Hmm, I will have to read it. We need to talk about the time in which he lived. You write, what saved him was his extraordinarily acute compassion, and he had a lot to be compassionate about because around him was injustice in abundance. What were the conditions in the Gilded Age? What was he looking at?
Well, you had this amazing change in America happening at the time of the Civil War. Before then, as Darrow used to say, it was a small-town Jeffersonian idyllic America, and there might be a guy who got ahead of the rest of his neighbors and put together a small workshop, but the workmen would be invited to come over like a ranch hand and participate in Sunday dinner, and they could sit in the same pew on Sunday with the boss, and they could even court and marry the boss's daughter. With the industrial age, and especially the way it was accelerated during the Civil War and the years immediately thereafter, you had huge economies of scale with steam engines and machinery and huge factories growing up. You had a big tide of immigrants coming in from Eastern and Western Europe, filling the cities and the tenements, and America changed quite drastically. And the old principle of individualism was sort of turned over by the lawyers of that age into a defense of property above all, rather than a defense of individual rights. And Darrow's greatest fight throughout his entire life was this fight for individual rights rather than just the rights of ownership.
Mm-hmm. Some of the working conditions that you described and that he described in Oshkosh, we'll need to talk about Oshkosh because you're talking to Wisconsin today.
Sure.
The miners, the railroad workers, just unbelievably deplorable.
Yeah, one of the ones that, there's a great picture in the book as well, but one of the ones that really touch your heart are these guys called Breaker Boys. And basically, if you grew up in a small mining community where they were mining coal, the coal would come out of the ground and it would be put up into these giant towering structures called breakers. And through a series of chutes and sieves, they would rumble down to get the coal separated from the shale or whatever the waste rock was that was extracted when the coal was. And, of course, they didn't have any sophisticated machinery then as they did now. And what they did is they took 11, 12, 8, 9, 14-year-old boys and stuck them there on benches all day long as the coal ran down between their feet, and they bent over and they picked the slate out and let the coal go through. And if they were too negligent in their duty, there was an overseer with a switch or a stick there to smack them on the shoulders. And this is what life was for many small boys in northeastern Pennsylvania and across over to the Ohio border.
And he would bring, when he was trying these cases, some of those people you described into the courtroom.
He would. He was one of the things about Darrow was that he had this great sense of how he could take one court case and make it sort of stand as a drama,
right,
for the issue that he wanted to call attention to. And then, and it happened that he would pick his cases for this reason, but then also in the way that he presented a case, he would also try to go beyond just the individual fight that was happening in that courtroom for the individual defendant, but actually try to say something to the country at large. And of course, in the Monkey trial was the biggest drama. It was more of a comedy or a farce, I guess. But in Leopold and Loeb, for example, what Darryl wanted to talk about was the death penalty and teenagers. And in a wonderful case towards the end of his career in Detroit, when he represented the
yes.
Sweet family,
mm-hmm.
which were African Americans who had fired into a white mob that had besieged them, he wanted to talk about whether or not black people had the rights to defend their home as their castle, like white people did. So he was always looking for the bigger issue that he could use, and then he was dramatizing it. He would stage these little morality plays in the courtroom.
I love your description of it wasn't unusual for the galleries to be packed with prominent lawyers, off-duty judges, newspapermen, and politicians, and the hallways outside jammed with spectators trying to get in to see Darryl close for the defense. That must have been a sight to behold.
Yeah, there was a couple of stories that I love. One was there was a small case in Indiana where some bank robbers, I guess, had gone down from Chicago and held up a bank. And meanwhile, the townspeople heard that they were in the bank, and so they surrounded the bank with their shotguns. And there was this big gun battle, and one of the townspeople was killed before the bank robbers surrendered. And so Darryl was called, and he went down there to defend the city boys. And it was such a big event for this small town in Indiana that people brought ladders, and against all the outside walls of the courthouse, they would climb up on the ladders so they could watch in through the window because all the seats were taken in the courtroom. But in several of the cases in Los Angeles, when he was being tried for bribing jurors, and in Leopold and Loeb, on several occasions, they literally had to get flying squads of state police to push the crowds aside just to get the judge and Darryl and the prosecuting attorneys into the courtroom.
And the closing arguments, it's hard to believe now with this rapid-fire information age that we live in, but he would talk for sometimes as long as 3 hours, and then he would finish up his closing arguments the next day, maybe another 3 hours, maybe two.
Yeah, and Leopold and Loeb was the best example of that. It began on a Friday, and he spoke all day on Friday. Then there was only a Saturday session, so he spoke Saturday morning, and then he rested on Sunday, and then I came back on Monday and spoke for the entire day. So over 3 days, he made that plea to save their lives. The thing about Darryl is that you don't find an awful lot of cases where Darryl convinces the jury to acquit someone, which is why it's sort of the name of the book is Attorney for the Damned. What he does is he saves their necks. He saves their necks by convincing juries and judges or parole boards or governors that this individual has some decency, was caught up in a web of events beyond their power, and manages to save them from the death penalty. But he's not the kind of guy that like a Perry Mason who pulls a rabbit out of his hat in the last 20 minutes of the final arguments and gets a not guilty verdict.
Mm-hmm.
There were many gangsters and corrupt politicians that he indeed got off not guilty, but these are not his famous cases. His most famous cases are for saving people's lives.
Yeah. He had as everybody does, I think, but he had a lot of thoughts about and concerns about money because he had a wife and a child, and then he had a divorce, and he had two wives and a child. And so some of the cases he just took for free. Did he have to take some cases that he would prefer not to have? And did he have concerns about that just because he needed the dough?
Yes, he took, he represented everybody. He represented bootleggers and drunk drivers, fancy divorces. And at the end of his life, he took a particularly unfortunate case where he went to Hawaii and defended basically a lynch mob, a small group that had taken a defendant in a rape case and were threatening him and eventually shot the defendant and then were put on trial. But because the defendant was a native Hawaiian and the gang were a white U.S. Navy personnel largely, it became a big to-do back here on the mainland, and there was a lot of money in the family, as it turned out. And so Darryl went to represent the lynch mob, which was, again, it was unfortunate. He said that he conceded at the time that he did it because he had lost all his money in the great crash in 1929, and because he always wanted to see Hawaii.
Of course, he just wanted to do that. And getting back, I wanted to ask you, did he indeed bribe jurors in any occasion?
I reached the conclusion that he did. I mean, I think that the evidence that I was able to assemble on top of what historians who have walked this path before had collected pretty much convinced me that that he was guilty of jury bribing. Not in that he may have directly, you know, taken a bunch of cash and handed it to a juror, but that he had some knowledge, and he certainly partook with members of his defense team, underlings who did that kind of stuff. And I just could not believe that he didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm. He was very involved politically. I didn't realize the extent of his desire to run for office. And he was mentioned for being mayor of Chicago at one point and running for Congress. Tell me about that part of his life.
He was torn on this issue. He did run for Congress once and was defeated. And part of the reason that he was defeated may have been that he just didn't do it wholeheartedly. I think that he always had the feeling in the back of his mind that if he could pull off the trick that William Jennings Bryan did and dazzle and stampede a convention and become a presidential candidate, that would be fine. But that actually going and doing things as the mayor of Chicago and doing the cutting the deals and selling the contracts and doing all the hard work would have just have distracted him from sort of a lazy philosophical life that he enjoyed. So there was definitely a love-hate relationship that he had with politics.
Mm-hmm.
But when he did get involved, it was very noteworthy. At the end of the 19th century, the great populist movement swept through the country, and we think of it as a movement in the farms, but there were actually people like Darrow who got together and tried to couple the Democratic vote in the inner cities, the working man's vote, with the populists from out in the farms or the miners. And in Chicago was a great test case, and he was part of that movement, a very important part of that movement to try to bring populism into the cities in the last few years of the 19th century.
You mentioned William Jennings Bryan, and most of us are very familiar with the Scopes trial, but 31 years before the Scopes trial, he had another encounter with Bryan, and a guy that he didn't like very much, but he was also a little jealous of him.
I think so, and part of what he thought about Bryan was that Bryan's heart may have been in the right place, and that Bryan really did turn the Democratic Party into the party of the little guy, and so Darrow certainly appreciated that. But he didn't think that Bryan was a particularly smart man. He didn't like Bryan's very fundamentalist religious views. And he always sort of, in the back of his mind, I think, thought that, oh, my God, why is this guy getting the presidential nomination three times and is getting to serve as Secretary of State when he's not a very smart individual? And I think that jealousy sort of grew in Darrow. And when he finally got the chance to ambush Bryan in the Scopes Monkey trial, I think he did so with some personal relish, not just on behalf of the cause.
We always seem to be having a bit of a problem with smart individuals in politics, don't we?
Yeah, but William Jennings Bryan was a very interesting man. Probably, no, the lesson of William Jennings Bryan is to make sure that you close on a good note. Because
yes,
his whole, what a very good career was somewhat tarnished by the fact what happened in the Monkey Trial.
Oh, yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of a wonderful new book, a biography of Clarence Darrow. Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. John Farrell is our guest. He's also author of the bestseller Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, and let's start with Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. Darrow was invited by the NAACP in 1931 to represent the Scottsboro Boys.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble was the NAACP had botched the case, and the parents of the boys had signed up with a rival group called the International Labor Defense, which was what we call today a communist front. But, you know, there would have been great advantage. They negotiated. And, of course, Darrow would have liked to take the case, taken the case. But there was a conflict between the NAA approach of legal defense versus the ILD approach, which was to have a lawyer who's good, but also have agitation outside the courtroom, outside the city, outside the country. And the communists made this into an international case, sending the mothers to Europe, speaking against racial oppression in the American South. They did have, they had Samuel Leibovitz, who at the time was a superb lawyer, and there's no doubt when he put the people on the stand that he proved the boys innocent. Darrow, however, was in a sense trying to take the case away from them.
All right, let's get some information from the author on that particular case. John?
Yeah, that was a very accurate description of what happened, and it's one of the great what-ifs of history as to whether or not Darrow could have done better for the Scottsboro boys. But that was the NAACP did indeed botch the case. They allowed it to be taken over by the ILD. And Darrow went down there and offered. His last offer was that he would actually work for the ILD, but he would have to have control of the courtroom tactics. And because the International Labor Defense was thinking more about the propaganda effects that they could do, they said, no, you're going to have to do what we say, and which was a shame because some of those Scottsboro boys did not get out of jail until the 1950s.
Thanks for the call, Hugh. Fred in Madison. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good.
Good.
I'm fascinated by Clarence Darrow, and one of the things that I read, particularly, I did read your guest's book, and I also read The Big Trouble, which was a fascinating book about his defense of a case in Idaho involving the assassination of a governor. But in that book about The Big Trouble, they talked at length about Darrow's service, I believe, as a socialist member of the Illinois legislature. And I wonder if the author has any further thoughts on that. What did he do? Why did he stay there? How long did he serve? What type of legislation did he deal with? Obviously, I, as both a former judge and a state legislator, am interested in that.
This is Fred Kessler calling. He's a state legislator who happens to be listening to the show.
Well, Fred, he was a socialist with a small S. He never actually made the leap and joined the Socialist Party. He did join many socialist causes and many liberal causes. He sort of bounced around the left, and this was somewhat typical for people during the populist and the progressive eras because you didn't have really established parties. Even the great communist party breakup with John Reed that happened in the early 20th century was a good example of how these parties would come together and then they would fragment. So yes, Darrow was definitely involved, but the issue will sound funny these days. The great issue at that time was whether or not the city of Chicago could run its own streetcars, and the streetcar companies had been given franchises, and through corruption they had gotten 99-year leases for a pittance to the taxpayers to run these streetcars. The service was horrible. They were freezing in winter and boiling hot in the summertime. And so this became the great populist and progressive cause of around the turn of the century. So Darrow went down. He was elected to the state legislature. He went down to Springfield and engaged in a series of wonderfully colorful battles over trying to get Chicago the right from the state of Illinois to buy and run its own streetcar service, including one in which the Speaker of the House, who was probably the corrupt tool of the streetcar companies, gaveled a bill through quickly, and all of Darrow and his colleagues basically staged a near riot in the chamber, standing on their desks, getting into fistfights and tussles, storming the dais and chasing the Speaker off. And basically, they did an impromptu impeachment and scared the Speaker back into his office. They took over the chamber, and the state police had to be called. And it was the only incident that I came across where Darrow showed any propensity for physical violence. At one point, he took a trash can and turned it upside down and put it on one of his opponent's heads.
So. That's a great story. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the case of the killing of the former Idaho governor?
Yes, it was a fascinating case. The Western Federation of Miners, again, a fledgling union trying to start out in the West, meeting resistance from the mine owners. And because you had this Western background where, things were settled in the Wild West by rifles and dynamite and six-shooters, it was a very violent battle that went on for 20 or 30 years all over Nevada, Colorado, and in this case, Idaho. And the Idaho governor had made some decisions that were unfavorable to the union, and one day he was walking home, got to his house, and as his children looked out the window on a snowy night, he opened the gate to his yard, and a dynamite bomb exploded. Mm. Now, the mine owners controlled the Idaho state government and the judicial system, and managed with the aid of the Pinkerton detectives to snatch the Western Federation of Miner leaders out of the streets of Denver, Colorado, put them on a special train and speed them through the night to Idaho, and put them on trial. And so the whole thing became a great union cause, and the riddle to this day is whether or not Big Bill Haywood, who was the union treasurer and was the first to go on trial, did indeed know and have connections with the bomber, who was actually arrested very quickly before he could even get out of town. It's a fascinating case, and Tony Lucas's book, Big Trouble, is wonderfully in capturing all the spirit of the times. Darryl went and defended the Federation officers for almost 3 years, and in that time he won five different cases. He won four of them, and nobody from the Federation was ever convicted for any of these crimes. Hmm.
Thanks, Fred, so much for the call. Maggie in Blue River. Hello, Maggie.
Hi. I wanted to take us on a little side trip into the central sands of Wisconsin. There's a famous married couple who are gone now but should be remembered by everybody, a pair of naturalists and biologists, Frederick and Frances Hammerstrom. And Frederick was Clarence Darrow's nephew. Ruby was his aunt. And there are some interesting stories in a book called Mice in the Freezer, Owls on the Porch, written by Helen Cornelli, about encounters they had and the relationship they had, which was very close. And so I just wanted to hear what your author had to say about that.
Yes, it's a wonderful little book. One of the great things about the family was that last year, just in time so I could get it into the book, they began to, they transferred to the University of Minnesota, the love letters between Clarence and Ruby, which are wonderful little portraits of their love affair and their marriage. And it was a great help to me that the family turned these over to the university. The university has done a fascinating job taking all these letters and another catch of letters that I'll talk about in a second and putting them online in just a terrific website.
Oh, nice.
With all the transcripts. I mean, if you have the patience to take down PDF after PDF, you can actually read the authentic transcript of the bribery trial in Los Angeles, for example. So all that information is there for scholars. I told my wife that I would never have to leave the kitchen if it had been available when I started work on the book. But the reason I chose Darrow was in part because on the other side of the family, his own granddaughters had gotten a knock on the door one day, and a letter collector from Minnesota named Randy Teachin knocked on their door and said, do you think by any chance you have any old letters from your famous grandfather down in the basement or up in the attic? And they went downstairs to the basement, and they got this box that said Christmas ornaments. And they took off a cover, and there were 1,000 letters to and from Darrow from people like Franklin Roosevelt.
Oh, my goodness.
And Helen Keller and other famous people that and they were also the most personal letters that they had decided not to give to the Library of Congress about finances and Darrow's divorce and things like that. So this was another just marvelous a bunch of stuff for researchers.
Yeah.
And that's all online now at this website. If you really are a Darrow fan, you probably already know about it, but if not, you should.
Okay. And what's the website again?
It's called the Clarence Darrow Collection, and it's the University of Minnesota Law Library.
Okay, Clarence Darrow Collection. Let's talk a little bit about his personal life, because it is fairly fascinating. He kind of believed in free love, and who knew about free love in the Gilded Age? Unfaithful man, divorced, remarried, slept with lots of women, must have been highly sexed young man, or he was just looking for an escape from the horrors of the age. What was going on with him?
Well, part of it, you hit on it towards the end. Part of it was that he used sex as a relief. He had, like you said at the very beginning, he had no organized faith. He sort of pretty much believed that life was a dead end, and that the pain of existence was such that the best we could do was just sort of help each other through it. And that's where that great empathy comes from. But to distract yourself and to help pass the hours, he believed in work and he also believed in sex. In his defense, free love, we think of free love now as this sort of Woodstock in the 60s, but mm-hmm. At the turn of the century, the free love movement was actually something quite serious, and it was had some ties to early feminism. The idea was that women weren't chattel, and that if you got married and it was an awful marriage, that you should be able to get a divorce and go on with your life. At its most extremes, it was that women had control over their own bodies, and the revolutionary thought that they should sleep with whoever they wanted instead of being branded as a slut, as someone on radio might say today.
Oh.
So he was at least philosophically consistent, and I will say that of his many mistresses and assignations, I could not find any that branded him as a heel. Most of them recognized that he was somewhat kind and generous and just the kind of guy that he was.
Mm-hmm. We need to find a book on the free love movements and do it during pledge drive, because then we got sex and history at the same time. And isn't that public radio when people pledge for that? If you know of one, let us know and we'll try and book it.
Probably in rural Wisconsin and definitely in rural New England, there are small town newspapers still where the town librarian will type up a little column about the new books that came into the library. And somebody sent me one from the from rural Maine, and she said, this is a book that if you like courtroom drama and celebrity gossip, you'll probably like this one. So I wasn't sure. I was glad that the four people in the little town would go read it in the library. But I didn't think of myself as a celebrity gossipist of the 19th century.
Thank you, Maggie, so much for your call. Chris in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I've always wondered if Clarence Darrow sided with determinism or something else. I just want to add, as you know, of course, there's a very old debate between free will and determinism. It's my guess that free will is probably a religious idea. And I'd like to add that in 1984, scientist Isaac Asimov said that there may be a third possibility, given what we know about quantum uncertainty, that apparently wrecks determinism, but it doesn't establish free will either, and that there's some third option involving randomness and chance. What did Darrow say about the role of randomness and chance in human behavior?
No, there's a question for you, John.
I'm ready for it.
All right.
Now, he was definitely a determinist. He didn't believe that there was... Well, he called himself an agnostic. He never... And for the same reason that he never believed in an organized faith, he wouldn't come right out and say, I'm an atheist. What he said is that it's beyond human comprehension, so the furthest I can go is to call myself an agnostic. I don't believe it, but I can't prove it to you that we are indeed... A random accident here on the planet. But one of the great contributions that he and his one of his great sponsors, Governor John Altgeld, gave to criminal justice theory and drives conservatives crazy to this day is the idea that there's very little that you are responsible for, that basically between your genetic makeup and the environment in which you're raised and the streets on which you're brought up, the kind of household, what your parents are like, that all these factors move human beings, and actually the question of free will, which was at that time how most cases were decided, really should be taken out of it. And the only question that that Darrow recognized in a courtroom was motive. So he believed that the best that we can do is have mercy and kindness towards each other. And in many different writings, he talked about, you know, being shipmates on a ship, storm-tossed ocean, and the best thing we can do is just give comfort to our fellow shipmates.
Hmm. We have to go to Oshkosh for a little bit of this show, A Case Watch Nationally, as a test of the right to organize. Darrow was in Oshkosh defending Thomas Kidd. Who was Thomas Kidd? And tell me more about the Payne Lumber Company and why Darrow got involved.
Yeah, there had been a huge case several years earlier in Chicago, Eugene Debs, the Debs Rebellion, in which the American Railway Union took railway workers out on strike all over the country. And at that time, the Attorney General of the United States basically went out and got injunctions, the criminal injunctions, to stop the strike and to jail the union leaders. Thomas Kidd was a friend, a union leader from Chicago, who's a friend of Darrow's, and in 1898 he was trying to organize the woodworkers in Oshkosh. At that time, it was a town of only about 28,000, mostly workers who worked for under a dollar a day for six or seven big manufacturing companies that dominated the town and the town society. Whenever there was a seasonal layoff in the construction industry, obviously the woodworkers who were making doors and windows would be laid off. But even that was too much for the mill owners, and they started hiring the mill workers, women and children, to pay them 60 cents a day for a 10-hour day. And the factories were run like prison camps, and there's a great segment of the rules of the Payne Lumber Company. It says, quote, "All employees are to be in their places when the bell rings and whistle blows for starting and must not absent themselves. Mm. Employees who quit their places without our consent are subject to damages. No unnecessary talking will be allowed during working hours." Mm. And you actually had to raise your hand and get a foreman to take you out the locked door so that you could go to the bathroom in the middle of the day. So Darrow went there, and as in many of his cases, what he tried to do was to put the mill owners on trial. And he chose this fellow, George Payne of the Payne Company, as sort of the Dickensian villain, gave a great speech, and in this case, got Kidd acquitted. This was one of those cases where he actually won a not guilty verdict, and there was always a feeling that the fact that his dad had been a woodworker, owned a small furniture shop, made this particular victory very sweet for Darrow.
Hmm. Clarence Darrow, attorney for the damned. Our conversation this hour with the author of the book, John Farrell. Our number and a couple lines are open now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you can always use an email if you want to do that, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, Judy in Menominee. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm wondering if the author knows anything about Matilda Fenberg, who went to share the office space with Clarence Darrow back in the 20s, and she got to meet a lot of interesting people because of knowing him, and she was one of the leaders in the Women's Lawyers Association in the country.
Is she a relative? I recognize the name.
Not a relative. No, she was one of the first graduated lawyers in the country, women lawyers, and she went to work in his office and became good friends with him. I have some material about her and her impression of him.
Yeah. She was, Darrow's relationship with women was very complex, like we talked about before. He was a great romancer of women. But he also got upset with them, although he was politically. He started out supporting the right of the women to vote, and he was probably influenced by his mother about women's suffrage. But as you got into the 1910s and 1920s, there was an alliance that was formed between the suffragettes and the prohibition movement, and Darrow was fiercely opposed to the prohibition movement because he was for individual liberty. So at that time, he began to say, and the record is filled with a lot of sarcastic remarks about women turning out to be no better than men, being willing to be led along by the preachers and the prohibitionists. But in his personal life, in his personal professional life, he had took in a series of women like Matilda to work in his office or to have space in his office and profit from the firm's name. As with his sex life, the whole question about what he thought of women as professionals is a little complicated, and if you want to build an argument for or against him, you can. What I try to do in the book is just spread out the facts and let you make your judgment.
Yeah. Thanks, Judy, very much for the call. You start the book with Darrow in a very different position as a lawyer for the railroad. Can you talk about the moment where, as somebody described this, he crossed over to where he belonged?
Yeah, it came in the 1890s. He had come to Chicago. He had started out. He had gotten involved in trying to get a pardon for the Haymarket anarchists who were arrested and some were executed unfairly for a riot in Haymarket Square in Chicago. So he was dabbling in social causes, but he had a wife and a son, and he wanted to make his way in Chicago, which was a very competitive city at that time, and he got one of the true plums, which was through his political connections, he got a job as an assistant counsel at one of the great railroads, and the railroads dominated American industrial society at that time the way that, well, you'd have to probably put Apple and IBM and Microsoft and Google all together to come up with what the railroads were like. So he had it made, to his great credit, a series of cases came along. Eugene Prendergast, who was arrested and was going to be hanged for assassinating the mayor of Chicago, and Darrow was infuriated by the notion that someone who was clearly insane, that the medical profession was telling him was insane, was going to be hanged, even though he was incompetent to have committed murder. He jumped into that case, and then, of course, he jumped into the great defensive Eugene Debs and the American Railway Union against the railroad. That's where he truly made a national name for himself for the first time. So it was an act of conscience. There's a great early biography of Clarence Darrow called Clarence Darrow for the Defense, written by Irving Stone, who dramatizes the moment, boils it all down to a 1 hour scene that he paints in the office of the railway, where Clarence comes up and tells the railway union that he just can't go against the working man any longer. And it was a little bit more complicated than that, but he did have to cross over and decide which way his path was going to go. And when he did, it was on the side of individual liberty. Yeah.
I haven't read that Irving Stone book. Is it good?
Oh, it's very good. It's a wonderful book. It's one of the best probably written biographies ever. I mean, Irving Stone was a masterful writer. Just a great wordsmith, had the ability to take a complex story and make it a real read like a thriller.
Yeah, I'll have to read that. And a couple people we haven't talked about Inherit the Wind yet, or Orson Welles' portrayal of Darrow, or Spencer Tracy. Oh, I loved him in that movie. Do you have a favorite, and why did he become the subject of films?
I think the inherent drama in the courtroom lends itself to Hollywood movies. And what's interesting, too, is that I think if you're trying to look, unfortunately, there is no talking film survives of Darrow in the courtroom. The few clips that you can find of him talking at all happen at the very end of his life, and you get no idea for the power of what he was like. That said, I think he, from the description, that he probably was much like Orson Welles in the film Compulsion, which is a thinly veiled drama about the Leopold and Loeb case, in which Orson Welles plays Darrow and takes huge chunks of the actual record and writes it into the script. And that final closing argument goes on, 10, 20 minutes, far, far longer than any Hollywood director or screenwriter would ever let one go on today. If you go see a good courtroom drama today, the closing argument is four sentences instead of 4 days,
right.
Because they don't trust us anymore to maintain our interest. But of course, the other great portrait of Darrow was Spencer Tracy in Inherit the Wind, which is a marvelous play and a marvelous motion picture, in which, again, huge chunks of the transcript were written into the courtroom scenes. It ends, of course, with a great confrontation between the Darrow character and the William Jennings Bryan character and in the Monkey Trial. The movie is a romantic version of what happened. The actual John Scopes never really faced the persecution like the poor teacher in the movie. In fact, the great thing about the Monkey Trial was that it was all by accident. It was all supposed to be just a little staged show. The people from Dayton, Tennessee, sent a telegram to the American Civil Liberties Union, which was looking for a test case that they could take to the Supreme Court. And with the defendant's knowledge and approval, said, "Don't worry about it. We'll convict him, and you'll have your test case." So there was never really a lot of drama that what was going to happen in real life, like there is in the motion picture.
Yeah, it was a great. Did he win? I know he was nominated for an Oscar for that. Did he win it?
I don't know. I should know that, but.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to find out. How did he die?
Darrow?
Mm-hmm.
It was a slow decline. People ask me, how can you, glorify this guy who, bribed jurors and cut a lot of corners and represented, bootleggers and gangsters and some pretty evil people? And I always point to right after Leopold and Loeb and the Scopes Monkey Trial, Darrow was at the height of his powers and fame. And he could have had any case in the country. He could have gone to work for any corporation. He didn't have a lot of money. He needed money for his old age. And instead, he went to Detroit, and he represented the Sweet family, which I referred to earlier.
Yes.
And he had two very tough battles, one in the fall of 1925 and the next in the spring of 1926. And he finally won an acquittal. And the strain was too much for him, and he had a heart attack.
Mm.
And he recovered from it, but he was never the same. Mm-hmm. That was the last great case that he had. He would do smaller cases, and he would go out on the lecture circuit. And basically, it was a slow degeneration, probably, of hardening of the artery.
Hmm. Well, how could people even say? Of course, he was a complicated guy. It's not like you glorified him, but he was such a large measure of a man and so involved in so many important issues of the time that, of course, we have to admire him greatly for his intellect and, I guess, for his empathy, for his compassion, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those guys that you wonder what would have happened if, Kennedy or Nixon, he had focused his entire life on a political career, or he had just decided that he wanted to be a Supreme Court justice and went ahead and did one thing. But what's amazing about Darrow is that he's all over the place. He's political causes. He's writing novels. He's representing unions. He was always restless, always wanting to fill his life with intensity to get away from what he believed was the pain of this useless existence.
So how, John, do you choose your subjects? You've done Tip O'Neill and now Clarence Darrow. Why are you walking around in their shoes?
First of all, you have to pick somebody that you're willing to live with for 6 or 7 years.
Right, a long time.
Very important, very important. I haven't picked somebody that I don't like yet, and that would be a supreme test. So I like both these guys. They both were very witty, and in both cases, there was also a practical side, which is I had read the great book Truman by David McCullough, in which he explains how there was a cache of letters from Bess Truman that became open to historians for the first time and allowed them to say something new about Harry Truman. And in both these cases, Tip O'Neill's papers, became available to the public. And the Darrow letters that I referred to earlier at the University of Minnesota became open to scholars. And so they both gave me a chance to add something new to the historic record. The one great thing about biography is that as time passes, more and more people dig boxes out of their basement and call up the local university and say, "Do you think you'd like this?" Or some family makes a bequest and the papers sit there, and then finally the curator looks at them and they put them together and they say, "Hey, somebody should take a look about this." And so over time we get to revise the story as biographers, and I have no doubt probably that in another 40 years somebody will come along and find some equally fascinating material that will either say that I was right or I got it all wrong.
Hmm. Well, I just love the book. Thank you so much for being with us. And now it will carry me into, I'll have to see Inherit the Wind again and read Irving Stone's book. And it'll carry me to more reading. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Our guest this hour, the author of Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, John Farrell, our guest. The book has just been published by Doubleday, and I read a lot of books for this show. If this age in history fascinates you, and if he does, how could he not? It's very, very well done. John also wrote, we just made mention of it, the bestseller Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. He has worked at the Boston Globe, the Denver Post, is a senior writer now for the Center for Public Integrity. Well, that was fun. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. Be with you again mañana.